lures them out of the city. The Israeli occupation army is committing massacres in continuation of its Gaza occupation plan and is actually pressing ahead in advancing towards the most populated areas and neighborhoods in the north of Gaza. People or locals from Gaza City are reporting that the Israeli tanks are approaching towards the heart of the city from three different axes. The first is from Al-Karama area towards Ash-Shata refugee camp, the very populated area and the very densely populated area in the west of Gaza City. And the other is from Ash-Sheikh Ridwan near Birkat Ash-Sheikh Ridwan neighborhood. And that actually leads directly to the heart of the city. The Israeli occupation army is also progressing from the south of Tal al-Hawa neighborhoods towards Al-Zaytun. And by this progression, the Israeli occupation army is carpet bombing the areas ahead or paving the way towards the heart of the city. This dawn, the Israeli occupation army committed a massacre against Dokhmush family in Tal al-Hawa neighborhood that resulted in the killing of eight of the same family after targeting the residential building.
The U.S. administration is preparing another multi-billion dollar arms package for Israel, signaling a fresh surge of support for the regime. This as Tel Aviv faces growing international isolation over its genocidal war in Gaza. The White House has informed Congress of plans to sell nearly $6 billion worth of weapons to Israel, including Apache helicopters and infantry assault vehicles. Washington continues arming Israel despite mounting international pressure and efforts by a growing number of Senate Democrats to block such sales. The Trump administration has already approved $12 billion in major military assistance to Israel this year. The deals are part of a 10-year U.S.-Israel military agreement that is nearing its end. Since October 2023, several countries, including Italy, Japan, Spain, Canada, Colombia, the Netherlands and Belgium, have halted arms sales to Israel over its carnage of tens of thousands of civilians in Gaza. Portugal has announced its intention to recognize a Palestinian state, joining a list of European countries that have made a similar decision as global outcry towards Israeli genocide continues. The Portuguese foreign minister says his country will officially recognize a Palestinian state on Sunday. It comes ahead of a UN General Assembly where around 10 other countries are set to follow suit. Lisbon has said the decision is because of the unprecedented level of Israeli carnage in Gaza, coupled with the regime's continuous annexation of Palestinian lands in the occupied West Bank. So far, 10 out of 27 EU countries have recognized Palestine. Britain, France and Canada are also among Western countries planning to recognize Palestine at the upcoming UN General Assembly. The Israeli regime has heightened security measures in the occupied Palestinian territories after a car incident in the Tel Aviv that left at least one Israeli dead. Israel's Channel 12 has reported the incident as a suspected car ramming attack. The driver reportedly fled the scene and a search is on the way to arrest him. Israelis inside and outside the occupied territories have faced multiple attacks since the outbreak of the regime's genocidal war in Gaza in 2023. On Friday, a man was arrested in the Netherlands for allegedly attempting to set fire to the Israeli embassy in The Hague. A day earlier, a Jordanian truck driver shot and killed two Israeli soldiers at the main border crossing between the occupied West Bank and Jordan. Israeli forces continue their violence across the occupied West Bank, carrying out more raids and abducting more Palestinians. We were earlier joined by our correspondent Indra Malahnaka-Hamad with the latest updates.
The entire city of Al-Khalil has been under attack since the hours of the morning. We are talking about almost 200 arrests from inside Al-Khalil. In the villages of Abu al-Azja and Rabut to the south of Al-Khalil, 70 Palestinians have been abducted, and they are still under, until this moment, being captured by the Israeli forces, who are performing a large raid towards that area. Also in Beit Umar and to the north of Al-Khalil, at the Shiuch and Sa'ir, we are talking about tens of arrests among Palestinians. Of course, we have seen such actions in other cities and other cities and other villages where hundreds of Palestinians being detained, and later they be released. But after they are captured for hours, they are fieldly interrogated, they are intimidated, they are humiliated, and most of the time they are severely beaten to the extent that the Palestinian ambulance needs to take many of them towards the hospital. Like other raids happened throughout the West Bank. Over here in Ramallah, a confrontation happened between the Palestinians and raiding IOF forces.
The Committee to Protect Journalists has reported that 31 journalists and media workers were killed in Israeli airstrike on a newspaper complex in Yemen last week. The September the 10th strikes targeted offices of the newspapers 26th of September and Yemen Daily in the capital Sana'a. At least 22 journalists were also injured in the attacks. The regime's army claimed that it had struck military targets belonging to the Ansarullah resistance movement. The attack marked the deadliest single strike on the press since 2009, when 32 journalists were killed in an attack in Philippines' southern province of Maguindanao. Since the beginning of its genocidal war on Gaza in 2023, Israel has also killed hundreds of journalists in the Palestinian territory and Lebanon. In Sana'a, thousands of Yemenis rallied again this Friday against Israel and its allies, slamming the regime's genocide of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. They also sent strong warnings to Saudi Arabia. More in this report.
Yemeni and Palestinian flags draped the 70 square as hundreds of thousands rallied in solidarity with Palestine, condemning U.S. and Israeli genocide in Gaza. Protesters also condemned Saudi Arabia and warned the kingdom of the dangers if it sides with Israel in any military operations against Yemen.
The Yemeni people are standing with Palestine against disgrace and humiliation. We are here in direct defiance against the U.S. and Israel. And we also send a warning to Saudi Arabia that if it gets involved in helping any of our enemies at sea, we will also deal with them.
Protesters also vowed that past Yemeni strikes prove Yemen's ability to hit back against Israel, U.S., and Saudi Arabia if necessary.
From this field of jihad, we tell the Zionists and the Americans that we will never fear your bombings on us. We will also send a message to those traitors, especially Saudi Arabia. Do not make the mistake of entering a battle you are not prepared for. Take heed of what we did to your Aramco facilities in the previous wars.
We condemn the failed Arab summit. They are only puppets of U.S. and Israel. We in Yemen stand firm as a mountain with our leader, and we will continue to attack by land, air, and sea against all enemies.
Yemenis are hoping for the best, but are preparing for the worst, an all-out battle with Israel and all its allies if the aggressions continue.
Yemen has stepped up its military operations, not only in support of Gaza, but to prevent what many believe is Israel's ultimate plan to take over parts of West Asia if the regime is not stopped immediately. Yusuf Mawri, Sana'a.
The UN Security Council has rejected a bid to keep sanctions relief for Iran, paving the way for renewed UN sanctions within days. Iran has slammed the move, calling any attempt by the European trio to reimpose sanctions baseless and a direct assault on international law.
Iran implemented the deal in full and in good faith. No other nation has ever subjected itself to such rigorous, intrusive verification by IAEA. We kept our words, the EU, ETA, and US did not. It was the United States that unilaterally tore up the agreement in 2018, imposing sanctions in open defiance of this council. It was the ETA that failed to meet their obligation, hiding behind empty promises while quietly following Washington's lead and instructions.
Iran's ambassador to the UN, Amir Saidi Ravani, emphasized that in a striking display of hypocrisy, the European trio and the US claimed that Tehran must be punished for measures it took only years after enduring their violations. The three European countries triggered the snapback process last month, accusing Iran of breaching uranium limits set by the 2015 nuclear deal. That mechanism, which is set to expire on October 18th, allows any JCPOA participant to restore UN sanctions unless the Council votes to stop it. If no deal is reached by September the 28th, international sanctions suspended under the nuclear deal will automatically return. Political activist Mohsen Arabi earlier told us that Iran has been clear about the rollback of its obligations in compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal. He said it is Western governments and not Iran that violated the deal.
Iran's position is quite clear. Like, they consider this attempt by these three European states to reinstate annulled UN Security Council sanctions as unlawful, unjustified, and provocative. This action in itself, it undermines basic norms of diplomacy at a very sensitive time when the world should be working towards peace and de-escalation and not escalation, you know? And because their claim is so baseless, the JCPOA, it's a multilateral agreement. And it's been endorsed by the UN Security Council in the past. And the U.S. withdrew unilaterally in 2018, as we all know. And the U.S. are who violated the deal. And since then, Iran has remained in compliance with its safeguards, its obligations under the IAEA. And instead of addressing the violations and illegal attacks by the U.S. and the Zionist regime against Iran's safeguarded nuclear facilities under IAEA, the E3 are abusing the JCPOA's mechanism to impose pressure on Iran. That is in itself a double violation.
Iran has strongly condemned France, Germany, and the UK for a provocative and unlawful action at the UN Security Council. In a statement, Iran's foreign ministry warned that if the move leads to the return of sanctions, the full responsibility will lie with the US and its European allies. The ministry said the push to revive sanctions lacked consensus and faced serious opposition from several council members, calling it a blow to diplomacy and a threat to the global non-proliferation regime. Meanwhile, Iran's foreign minister has held a phone call with the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency. The minister criticized the, quote, politicized atmosphere at the IAEA Board of Governors meeting, stressing that Iran's cooperation with the agency remains within international regulations. He said Iran does not accept any political action or unfair pressure that could lead to an escalation of tensions. Ukraine says its drones have targeted a major oil refinery deep inside the Russian territory for the second time this week. Russian residents in Saratov have reported hearing at least 11 explosions during the night. The major refinery is nearly 600 kilometers east of the front line in Ukraine. Ukrainian forces also launched a series of drone attacks in Russia's Kursk and Belgorod regions. Meanwhile, Ukrainian officials reported that Russian drone and rocket strikes killed three civilians in Vasilivka and Poloivka. Russian forces also seized two villages in Ukraine's Donetsk and Zaporizhia regions. The conflict, which began in February 2022, has triggered a prolonged and destructive war across the region. Moscow has cited increasing NATO military presence near its borders as the root cause of the conflict. Estonia says three Russian fighter jets have violated its airspace for 12 minutes in what the Eastern European country called an unprecedentedly brazen incursion. Estonia's government said three MiG-31 warplanes entered its airspace in a very clear act of provocation. The government also said it had summoned the Russian envoy to lodge a protest and deliver a note. Estonian Foreign Minister Margus Tsahkna separately called for a strong response from NATO. Just over a week ago, Poland also said around two dozen Russian drones violated its airspace. Moscow rejected that claim as a fabrication to derail Ukraine peace talks. And with that, we bring this news bulletin to an end. It's goodbye from me, Behman Ray.
It's so hard for an innocent angel. breathe on the earth, far from heaven. But for my angel, it was much harder to see me lost in the fire.
There should be no question that Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi was just waiting for the right moment to make this a global movement of the people.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Foresight and I'm your host Mehdi. Please stay with us. Today's tip: how practical our servitude must be to Allah the Almighty. Welcome back, dear friends. This is Foresight on IRIB English Radio. So we are talking about how practical our servitude must be to the Almighty Allah. You know, we have these various forms of worship. we have these various forms of ubudiyya, of the worship and the servitude and the obedience to the Almighty Allah. And all of this worship should lead to some practical changes in our lives. Of course, when one is engaged in ubudiyya, when one is engaged in worship, in the remembrance of the Almighty Allah, in the worship of the Almighty Allah, in the servitude of the Almighty Allah, in the obedience to the Almighty Allah, when one is engaged in the prayers and in the fasting, and as we said, the remembrance of the Almighty Allah, all in all, this ubudiyya, it moves us towards certain practical things. Now, those practical things usually are manifested in the way that we interact, or, for example, we could say, in the way that we behave with the different dimensions of the things that we are surrounded by. So when it comes to the moral and ethical akhlaq teachings, we find that every human being has four major relationships that they have. One is the relationship of the human being with their creator, the Almighty Allah. Then there is the relationship between a human being and their own self. Then there is the relationship between a human being with other human beings. And finally, there is the relationship between a human being and their environment. Now, this ubudiyya, in its overall and general and all-encompassing sense, what this does is that it balances and it brings peace and harmony to these different relationships that a human being, an individual, has on these four levels. So we kind of want to focus on one of those four, and that is the relationship that a human being has with other human beings. Now, this is probably one of the more common and prevalent relationships that we have. We're constantly surrounded by other people in society. And so based upon the things that we learn from the ubudiyya to the Almighty Allah, the worship and servitude and obedience to Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted, we should be able to fix and balance our relationship with other human beings along those lines.
IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
There should be no question that we have got a responsibility. There should be no question that Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi was just waiting for the right moment to make this a global movement of the people, but otherwise had started a lot earlier than that. Amir al-Mu'mineen has said, "Kul lidh-dhalimi khasman walil-madhlumi auna." You should be the enemy of anyone who oppresses, and you should side with whoever is oppressed. If we want to be technical here, and Imam Khomeini is very technical, as he is one of the top mujtahideen that we have had throughout history, that statement is mutlaq, they say. It is unconditional. It does not say, kun lidh-dhalimi khasman in kana al-madhlumu shi'iyan. It doesn't say be the enemy of the oppressor if that oppressor is oppressing a Shia. It doesn't even have in kana musliman. When he sent Malik al-Ashtar to Egypt, which had many non-Muslims still, and still today has non-Muslims, you can see. The Imam told him, they're either your brothers in faith, and he didn't distinguish between Muslims in that way. They're either your brothers in faith. He's not told when you go there, these guys, by the way, are not Shia. So treat them differently. No, he says they're either a brother in faith to you, or they're a brother in humanity. If they require your help, and if you're going there as a governor, they do need your help. You have got to provide for them. And you saw the amount of oppression that you see in the occupied lands, brothers and sisters, since before 1948, that day of Nakba, that the Zionist entity was established illegitimately. Even before then, the killings, the assassinations, the forced movements, moving out of their homes, and their cities and their villages had begun. In the prisons of the Zionist regime, God knows what happens. Some of these people who've lived through it, some of the ones who have lived through it, explaining how they were treated. It's difficult to imagine, brothers and sisters, sometimes we are living our comfortable lives and we don't realize how difficult the circumstances that people are in, and it's not really appropriate. We've got to try to, when we hear that, it should really shake us. I don't know if it really shook us when we saw those images, we heard the explanation. That statement of Amir al-Mu'mineen that says, if a believer hears jewels taken, anklets taken from the foot of a Jewish woman, if they die out of the sadness and sorrow, I would not blame them. It's worthy. That means that that's how you should feel when you hear that form of oppression. That's not even killing. That's not even torture. That's not even killing a man's son right before his eyes. It's not even killing his daughter, his wife, or a mother standing there and her child getting killed right before her eyes. When we hear that, wherever it is in the world, it should be something that hurts us.
Mother, don't cry for me, I'm heading off to war. God Almighty is my armor and sword. Palestine, forever Palestine. Children stones in the sky, they say to their parents, don't worry, God is on our side. Palestine, forever Palestine. Mother, don't worry when they come for us at night. Surely they'll be sorry when God puts them right. Tell me why they're doing what was done to them. Don't they know that God is with the oppressed and needy? He perished by the nations that rule through tyranny. Palestine, forever Palestine.
Welcome back, dear friends. So we are humbly talking about how practical our servitude must be to the Almighty Allah. Now, you know, we don't want to leave worship as something that takes us to the corner of the masjid, the corner of the mosque, or that, you know, we don't want our ubudiyya to lead us to isolating ourselves, secluding ourselves, leading a monastic life. The religion of Islam and the pure Muhammadan Islam and the teachings of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, as well as the infallible and immaculate Imams alayhim assalam, the 12 Imams, they teach us that as a human being we must be within society and have interactions in society, and we must be amongst the people. It's interesting that the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, he was among the people, and even the Holy Quran says that you should be grateful and you are blessed that you have a messenger who has come from among you. And so this isolationist type of point of view is against Islamic teachings. Now, when it comes to the present day, at the forefront we have the issue of Palestine. So it is, a very long time now, close to 2 years, where the people of Palestine have constantly been under bombardment. Their homes are constantly being destroyed. You know, according to certain numbers, well over, 80% of the Gaza Strip has, its infrastructure or its residential areas have been destroyed. According to some numbers released, almost 680,000 people have most probably been killed. These are, new estimates that are coming out. Previously, halfway, at the 1 year mark or so, estimates were at 300,000 people that have been killed. Now the estimates after 2 years is about 680,000 killed. There is a huge duty that a human being has towards another human being. One of those duties is to help them, to protect them, to support them, to give them aid, to save them from this criminal activities and these crimes and this genocide, really, that is occurring against them. This is what our Ubudiyya practically teaches us, at least in the dimension of our relationship as a human being with other human beings. And our Ubudiyya leads us to help each other because it is one of the principles that Islam puts forth. The worship of the Almighty Allah without concern for the other creations of the Almighty Allah is no Ubudiyya at all. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, Foresight. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.
Throughout history, mosques have always been serene havens for Muslim worshippers. Magnificent buildings have developed significantly during the years, and their unique and one-of-a-kind architecture has fascinated people throughout history. Iran is adorned with glorious mosques that invite you to a divine feast of colors, each reflecting the genius of their architect and the amount of skill and proficiency that goes into each and every detail. In Tehran, mosques are found on nearly every street corner, making it easy for Muslims to attend the daily prayers. The Imam Khomeini Mosque, located right inside the Tehran Bazaar, is one of the oldest structures in the city, dating back to the early 18th century. People in different parts of the bazaar have easy access to the courtyard, and so many retreat to this calm shelter for their daily prayers. Inside the mosque, one is spellbound by the amount of color that has gone into the intricate tiles decorating all the arches and niches. The elaborate geometric designs that adorn the walls and ceilings are also something to reflect on.
The architecture of mosques in the country vary from one region to another, depending on culture, heritage, and the resources available. Now, these buildings are different from each other in terms of color, the various symbolic patterns, and the different styles of tile work. But there are a few common elements that most of these mosques share with each other.
One of the common features of every mosque is the mihrab, a niche in the wall that indicates the direction towards which Muslims pray. Although the mihrab varies in size, they all have intricate arabesque and calligraphic designs made by joining numerous cut glazed tiles.
Beautiful pool has always been an inseparable part of the mosque because water is known for its purity, brightness, and transparency. Water has always been associated with the divine and also known as a purifying element.
The history of tile work in Iran goes back to the prehistoric period, but it was in the Islamic era that this unique art flourished and became the most important decorative feature of religious buildings. For Muslims, these floral patterns in distinctive colors, especially turquoise, deep blues, and rich reds, represent the infinite and convey a sense of spirituality.
Dignified, magnificent, and impressive. The architecture of the mosques in Tehran reflect creativity and beauty. Every tiny little detail creating an atmosphere of holiness and spirituality.
Apart from the floral designs, exceptional calligraphy works are also displayed on these tiles. Calligraphy is closely linked to geometry because the proportions of the letters are all governed by mathematics. Most mosques have some type of surface inscription, which might be a verse from the Quran, lines of poetry, or names and dates. Sometimes a single word, such as Allah or Muhammad, are repeated and arranged into patterns over the entire surface of the walls. The two other common features in most mosques are the minarets and domes. Minarets are tall towers that not only provide a visual focal point, but are also used for the call to prayer. Domes are also one of the signature forms in Islamic architecture, symbolically representing the vault of heaven.
One of the well-known mosques in Tehran's Chariati Street is Husseiniyeh-e Ershad, which was built half a century ago. This mosque is well known for all the political and historical events that happened here during the course of the years.
Our way of living changes as the years go by, but some things in life stay the same. People come, people go, but they remain standing. The architecture of the mosques in Iran is part of eternity, echoing the glorious image of God in its every detail and corner. Hoda Lezgi for Iran.
Welcome back, dear listeners, and thank you for staying with us on Iran Radio, broadcasting from the heart of Tehran, the capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Here are some interesting facts about Islam. Muslim scholar Ibn al-Haytham, known as al-Hazen in Europe, who was born in 965 AD, formulated the scientific method and has been referred to as the world's first true scientist. He is also often regarded as the first theoretical physicist, making a significant contribution to the theory of light and optics. Additionally, he developed what is called celestial mechanics, which lead to the eventual work of Europeans such as Copernicus, Galileo, Johannes Kepler, and Isaac Newton. We'll listen to the continuation of Iran Radio. Thank you for joining us. Coming up in this hour, we begin with the Spotlight. Right after that, we turn to For Humanity, a reflective program that explores key aspects of human life as addressed in the Holy Quran, from personal development to social relationships and family dynamics. This segment offers a Quranic perspective on how to live with purpose and compassion in both private and communal life. Then stay tuned for Africa Today, where we take a comprehensive look at the political, economic, cultural, and business landscape across the African continent. This program provides a valuable overview of developments shaping Africa's present and future. Up next, Spotlight. Stay with us. There is much to explore.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone. The United States has deployed three guided missile destroyers, several warships, and a nuclear-powered submarine to waters near Venezuela to counter what it claims to be maritime narcotics trafficking. 2 weeks ago, Donald Trump rebranded the Department of Defense to the Department of War and then immediately moved nearly 4,000 U.S. sailors and Marines to Venezuelan waters where, in grave breach of international law, they attacked a small boat, resulting in the extrajudicial execution of 11 people on board a vessel. And that was just the first boat targeted. At the same time, U.S. authorities bumped up the prize on the Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro's head from 25 to 50 million U.S. dollars. And along with the massive flotilla deployment has prompted Caracas to mobilize and prepare for possible U.S. invasion. America's military deployment to Caribbean waters and looming potential of destabilizing outcome is the focus now of our Spotlight program. But first, here's our guests. Joining us is Don DeBar, radio host and journalist out of CPR News from New York. And Mr. Clyde Menzies, researcher and commentator, joining us from London. Gentlemen, hello. I'd like to welcome you both to the broadcast here. I guess, Don, we'll start with you. Good to check back in with you, and good to see you're safe and doing well. Don, your thoughts on this U.S. campaign to fight drugs near Venezuela, getting down there and immediately killing 11 Venezuelans on this small boat, no due process involved, no drugs or proof has been shared with any of us, the international community, and now another boat under the same circumstances, another three people killed, 14 in total, yet there's been no victim, there's been no proof laid for any of us to see. Your initial thoughts.
Well, let's see. So the U.S. military is going to solve the drug problem in the United States by killing Venezuelans in the Caribbean. They went to Afghanistan, as I recall, and brought back a huge heroin problem to the United States and Europe. They went to Vietnam, as a matter of fact, and had the same result. There is the experience of the Iran-Contra affair where the U.S. government actually brokered the sale of cocaine through Colombia and other points in Central South America. I don't think exactly these characters are the ones that are going to solve a drug problem. And if they are, certainly the way to do it is to shoot boats. And I would suspect finding the place where the drugs are growing and dealing with the government that is allowing it there by negotiation one way or another would be a place to at least start. You would want to bring international pressure if you're going to do something crazy like these people want to do. And I would assume that you would start by providing some evidence that there's drug cultivation or trade or something going on before you start shooting the place up. And finally, I'm thinking about as they blow up, the U.S. blows up boats directly in the Caribbean, the flotilla going to Gaza and the history of those people being, for example, nine people being executed on the deck of a boat in May of 2010, including an American. You know, maybe this is cover for what's about to happen with the next boatload of supplies for Gaza. I don't know. It doesn't make any sense to me. It makes as much sense as making Juan Guaido president of Venezuela made when John Bolton was on board last time.
All right. Thank you there, Don. And Mr. Clive Menzies, pleasure to have you. Thank you for your patience, sir. Your initial take on this massive U.S. naval flotilla now down there in the Caribbean in Venezuelan waters, over 4,000 sailors and Marines involved. Okay, where they are, the pretext the U.S. is using on fighting drugs there, what these this flotilla coalition has so far done, killing these 14 Venezuelans. The Colombian president, Gustavo Petro, has called it outright murder.
Well, undoubtedly it is extrajudicial killing. I think the wider question, there's a long history of fermenting regime change in Latin America. Over the last decade, we've seen the transition of, if you like, more socialist and sympathetic governments to their people, change in Argentina, Ecuador, Bolivia. Venezuela has been a consistent holdout, and that's why it's in the crosshairs. But actually, I think the timing is probably, as your other guest suggested, is much more to do with the destructive potential of this this outrage, for want of a better way of putting it. I mean, Trump is such an inconsistent individual, and as I've often said on your programs, these politicians, they are not in control, they're puppets. Certainly, Trump is something of a loose cannon, but he was claiming recently that he's done more to create peace in the Middle East than anybody else, which, you know, is just a nonsensical statement. And the man is inconsistent, contradicts himself, constantly claims one thing when doing the opposite. And I think this piece of, if you like, geopolitical theater, its primary role is to distract the attention, the rising awareness and outrage of what's going on in Gaza, with the full complicity of the US government and other governments in the West, and creating mayhem across that region, not to mention many other transgressions that are going on around the world. But I have said that for some time that these acts of madness or the craziness that is rising in the world is indicative of a dying structure. The structure that we've lived under for centuries is now at its apogee, and it's falling apart. And so there is a desperation to get ahead of the curve. So claiming drug running from Venezuela is just another attempt to try and, if you like, get ahead of the curve and distract people from what's really going on.
Great, Clive, and I'm glad you mentioned. Let's talk about getting ahead of that curve and distracting people. Don, all the places the U.S. could be fighting drugs right now, this is what makes this campaign extremely suspect, along the same narrative that Clive was just taking us through. Because Trump never mentioned drugs when it came to Venezuela till recently, not in his campaign. He did mention fentanyl every other day in Mexico, and that we might put boots on the ground into Mexican territory, fight Mexican drug cartels. And then that got a lot of blowback from the Mexican president, you very well remember. But he never mentioned the drug trade in Latin America going after Venezuela for drugs until very recently. And now let's get at some of the stats involved. In 2023, over 100,000 Americans overdosed from fentanyl, less than 30,000 from cocaine. Last year, the numbers were slightly down at 75,000 fentanyl, 25,000 from cocaine. Every other word out of his mouth was fentanyl and Mexico throughout his campaign. So why is he in the Caribbean in front of Caracas?
Well, first, the reason that he's doing this with Venezuela is obvious. It's oil. The same reason that they see nuclear weapons behind every tree in Iran, it's oil. The same reason that Russia is evil and bad is oil. The same reason, you go down the list, Nigeria, wherever, any place that there's oil that belongs to the people that own the United States, you people are all of you, the whole planet full of you, are sitting on top of their prized oil. If you don't get out of the way, they're going to drop bombs on you, and they'll have to make up stories to do that to satisfy the people. They're going to be driving around in cars with that oil here in the United States. But the purpose of this, obviously, is because they lost control of Venezuela's oil supply back with the election and the first administration of Hugo Chavez in 1998-99. In any event, even interrupting normal commerce, first with sanctions and now interrupting the sea lanes, I assume, coming in and out of Venezuela, there's some market control being exerted against Venezuela with respect to oil also. If you really want to solve the drug problem in the United States, because there's a huge market for drugs here. Why? Because people are scared to death. People are completely uncertain about their housing, their health care, income. The unemployment is massive. The official numbers are a joke, but also if you undo the changes that were made in the 80s and 90s and use the old numbers, even they're a joke. People under the age of 40 even at this point, have no idea how their lives are going to turn out because they are not ready for the world that's being constructed and delivered to them. And they're scared. And this is the kind of environment where people anesthetize themselves with drugs. And if they wanted to solve that problem for a tenth of the money they're spending on weapons and troops and every other damn thing, what they could do is give people jobs and some education to retool them for the world that is coming and pay for their health care and just make sure people feel secure enough that they don't feel the need to anesthetize themselves. It's entirely possible.
And the funny thing, Don, remember in his first term, he wanted to cut all these social programs to build his wall and pull around $3 or $4 billion out of social programs, to your point. Anyway, I'm going to put that same question, if I can, to you, Mr. Clive Menzies. I read this article earlier, so-called drug cartels Trump has reported to be in pursuit of, and I read this verbatim that said, although most of the cartels on the terrorism list are Mexican, Washington has focused its attacks on Venezuela. So, sir, let's visit this question again. Why? Why is the U.S. with such a huge fleet there off the Venezuelan coast?
Well, at the risk of repeating myself, it's largely a matter of distraction. And I think Don is correct in saying that, Iran has oil, Venezuela has oil, and that is part of the plan. But I think it's actually much wider than that. And in terms of the social situation in America, I don't think there is any intent from the government, which is controlled by higher forces, to actually make the American people feel better about themselves. There's been a war on us all, irrespective of where you live in the world. I mean, America is allegedly one of the richest countries in the world, and it's got something like 60 million people on food stamps. And, as Don says, there are many other social problems. I think if there was a serious intent to address the drugs problem, then people would emulate Portugal, which has turned drugs from a criminal problem into a social problem. So they don't criminalize drugs, but they actually provide social support, healthcare, making sure that people they have access to support when they have a problem with drugs. So there is no motivation or there is no intent to alleviate the pressure on populations around the world. So drugs are just one manifestation of the war on us all. And you go back to why. This war on us all began centuries ago, but in the current millennium, it started on 2000, 11th of September 2001, with the so-called war on terror. There's long been a so-called war on drugs. We've had the climate change narrative, which has created